So the other day, I was watching a television show, and there were two characters that were interacting in that particular scene. One was a very intellectual character, someone who was extremely highly educated, a very rational thinker, a very logical person. The other was the local security guard. They never tell you the details about this particular person, but we assume that he probably was high school education. But he also had a tendency, because of the facility he worked in, there were a lot of high-level lectures being given. He had a tendency to go attend a lot of those lectures. I mean, he had the run of the facility, so as a security officer, he could go stand in the back and listen to these academic lecturers lecture. So these two characters are having an interaction. And the rational, logical, highly educated character in this particular scene has always struggled with human interactions and human relationships, and in some ways not been able to see the value of them at all. And this security guard starts to tell her different things and finally says to her, really, we're just kind of going through this world and we're receiving these fuzzy signals from the universe, and we're just doing our best to make sense of it all. I kind of get his point. I probably would word it a different way. I certainly don't believe we're communicating with the universe as a whole, or I don't believe that chair is sending me signals, and I don't think trees are part of the Godhead and all of that. But I don't have any real solid experiences where I can tell you that God spoke to me audibly or vocally and specifically gave me instructions in that way. I've got his written word. He has written to me on several occasions. But sometimes I do think I feel like that I'm going through trying to interpret signals that I'm getting from time to time from God, trying to discern which signals are from him and which are from somewhere else. I'm trying to prayerfully approach life in a way that will ultimately be God-honoring, that will be pleasing to him and be helpful to his people. So I don't know if you all have similar experiences. Maybe you're getting signals right now this morning. Maybe you've gotten one already. Some of you may have already figured out this morning that I'd like to spend some time talking about a couple of people. And it's probably maybe somewhat obvious that those people are Abraham and Isaac. No, I'm just kidding. I've got two characters in the Bible on my mind today, and I want to read both of their stories. I realize they're a little long, but I want to read them both because I think they're interesting, and I think they have something in common. And I think I can prove that they go together, that they're two stories that should be studied and read together. The first one we're going to read is in 1 Kings chapter 17. This obviously is the story of the widow of Zarephath and her experience with a prophet named Elijah. I say that with great emphasis because in a few minutes we're going to talk about the prophet Elisha. And if you're not careful, if you're from the mountains and slur and speak the way I do, they can sound a lot alike, right? So this is Elijah, the first of the two prophets in 1 Kings chapter 17. We're going to start reading in verse 8, and we're going to read through the end of the chapter. This is the story of Elijah's interactions with this particular lady. This is in the word of the Lord came unto him, saying, Arise and get thee to Zarephath, which belongeth to Zidon, and dwell there. Behold, I have commanded a widow woman to sustain thee. Interesting. So he arose and went to Zarephath, and when he came to the gate of the city, behold, the widow woman was gathering of sticks. And he called to her and said, Fetch me, I pray thee, a little water in a vessel that I may drink. And as she was going to fetch it, he called to her and said, Bring me, I pray thee, a morsel of bread in thine hand. And she said, As the Lord thy God liveth, I have not a cake, but an handful of meal in a barrel, and a little oil in a cruse. And behold, I am gathering two sticks, that I may go in and dress it for me and my son, that we may eat it and die. Wow. That's a fairly dramatic scene, isn't it? Now, God had told Elijah to go to this place because he had commanded a widow woman to sustain him. He finds a widow woman and he asks her for sustenance, and her first response is to resist. Her first response is, I've just got enough here for a last small, insignificant meal for me and my son. And you know, she emphasizes the insignificance of that meal by even speaking of the wood she's gathering. So I'm going to get two sticks that I'm going to use to cook this little meal into a morsel of bread. And he and I are going to eat it, and then we're just going to wait for hunger to overtake us, and we're going to die. Now, does anybody understand, does anybody remember, particularly at this particular point of the story, at this particular point in the Old Testament, why it is that this widow woman might have been having so much trouble? Do you remember why? For at least 2 years now, they've been in drought. Matter of fact, Elijah is the one who prayed that God would withhold the rain. And now this woman, who lives in that region of the country, is suffering greatly because of the drought. I don't know if y'all realize how bad the drought is around here right now. It's pretty bad. Now, I'm thankful to see that the ground was wet this morning. Matter of fact, I've been over to Lake Ackworth a couple times. Some of you know where that is. It's supposed to be a constant level impoundment that Ackworth maintains with a dam with an overflow spillway. So it should stay, you know, there's a creek flowing in the backside. It's supposed to stay. It's not like Lake Altoona where they draw it down and fill it back up and draw it down. Lake Ackworth's supposed to be a fairly constant level impoundment. 3 weeks ago, I was over there, and it was about 2 inches below the top of the spillway. So there was no water going on the spillway yet, or at that time. It's because the inflow of the creek is lower than the evaporation rate from the lake. So I went back this week on Thursday, and it's literally 2.5 feet below the top of the spillway in a matter of a couple of weeks. I mean, that's incredible. That's a lot of water over that many acres to have evaporated out of there, and even though the creek's still flowing into it, the evaporation rate is way higher than the intake. So we're in a pretty bad drought situation here. I've actually heard people talk about, one of the brethren down at church yesterday talked about the fact that he had one of his contract workers that works with him come and do some grading. They dug down several inches into the ground, not several feet, several inches into the ground. And so this contractor told him to look at that. And no matter how far they dug, it seemed that the ground was just as dry as it could be. And he said he had never seen red clay in Georgia that dry that far down in all the years he'd been doing this kind of work. It's pretty dry out there, and we do need rain. But let me just suggest to you that it's nowhere close to what they were experiencing. 2 years. Not with below average rain. 2 years with no rain, most likely. We know it was 3 years and 6 months in the end, because that's what Jesus tells us. We know that. She's in dire straits here. So she's resisted a little bit. So let's continue on and read the rest of this. It says, and Elijah, verse 13, and Elijah said to her, fear not, go and do as thou hast said, but make me thereof a little cake first, and bring it unto me, and after make for thee and for thy son. For thus saith the Lord God of Israel, the barrel of meal shall not waste, neither shall the cruse of oil fail, until the day that the Lord sendeth rain upon the earth. And she went and did according to the saying of Elijah, and she and he and her house did eat many days. Let's pause there for a second and ask ourselves a question. If you were in her situation and a man came along and said, hey, I want you to make me something to eat, and you told him what she had told him just now, that all I had was enough to make one meal of bread for me and my son, and we're going to eat it and die. And he turned around and said, now look, okay, I hear you. Go ahead and make it, but give me my portion first, because if you'll do that, your flour bin and your oil cruse will never run dry until the Lord sends rain. How quick would you be to believe him? Would you jump on that opportunity? Would you say, "Well, yeah, that's a good trade, isn't it?" How is he going to make this happen? Well, here's the point. God had told Elijah to go to a widow woman, and that God had commanded her already that she might sustain him. So you see, God was working on both ends of this story. And I think that's important to understand, because we're not always so quick to have that kind of faith, right? And sometimes we read about these people and think, wow, that just can't be real. She couldn't have just made that decision so easily and just went ahead and made him this, you know, this is a man she didn't even know, and she decides to believe him, and that's just, that's got to be fantasy land, right? No, it's not fantasy land. It's God working on both ends of the story. It's God sending Elijah, and it's also God preparing this widow woman, right? It's God working on Jonah and God preparing a fish.
Amen.
Right? It's God working on both ends of this scenario. Okay? So let's continue on, because it gets even more dramatic as we go on. It says, "And she went and did according to the saying of Elijah, and she and he and her house did eat many days. And the barrel of meal wasted not, and neither did the cruse of oil fail, according to the word of the Lord, which spake by Elijah." Now, it doesn't tell us this, but I'm going to tell you what I think right now, and you can throw it out if you want to. This is the part you don't have to carry home as inspired. This is Marty Hoffman just trying to get this image in my head. I don't think her cruse of oil and her bin of flour overflowed.
Right.
I think that every day that she went in there, there was enough in each for the next meal she was about to prepare. And she would scrape it clean. And then she'd make and bake, and it'd come time for the next meal, and she'd go back to that very bin that she had scraped clean, that very cruse of oil that she had drained, and there would be enough in there for the next meal. For her, for her son, and for the man of God. Isn't that something? Do you realize that's exactly how God blesses the gospel to be preached?
Amen.
That's exactly the way it works. Most gospel preachers that I know of are not vessels that are 55-gallon drums that contain enough for months at a time. Most are like one preacher told me when I asked him about his study habits, how when I was young in the ministry and I was trying to figure out how to prepare for a Sunday, especially once I began pastoring churches that met every Sunday. How do you go about studying? I asked this preacher, I said, "How do you do it?" And he told me, he said, "Well, I'll tell you what." He said, "Toward the beginning of the week, I study kind of generally. Toward the middle of the week, Wednesday or so, maybe into Thursday, I start to study a little more specifically." And he said, "On Saturday, I study desperately." And I thought, you know, I like that method. It kind of works for me. Kind of the way I feel most of the time. And it kind of speaks to the fact that each week it's something, it starts all over again, right? You know, it doesn't seem like God fills me up like a 55-gallon drum and I can pour it out in segments over months and months. The gospel comes much the same way. That's not the end of our story, by the way. They ate for many days. But there's more to it than that. Verse 17. "And it came to pass after these things that the son of the woman, the mistress of the house, fell sick. And his sickness was so sore that there was no breath left in him." Let's not belabor the point. He died. He died. It's just a poetic way of saying her son passed. We know that. We'll find out later because, you know, spoiler alert, Elijah's going to raise him from the dead. And it's going to tell us that his soul came back to him. Now, I know Elijah didn't raise him from the dead. God raised that child from the dead using Elijah as an instrument. Okay? So here's what happens. And she said unto Elijah, what have I to do with thee, O thou man of God? Art thou come to me to call my sin to remembrance and to slay my son? Is this why you were really here? First, you wanted to take our last morsel of bread that we were going to eat and die. Then you promised me a full bin and a full cruise and get my hopes up to the point that I think we are now safe and we'll survive this famine. And now my son is gone. I can't imagine the heart-wrenching moment. I can't imagine the thoughts of her mind that may have even said, you know what? I would rather have died with him before you came than to have endured the death of my own child and to now live without him. Can't imagine. Verse 19. And he said unto her, give me thy son. Well, there's a big request, is it not? Give me thy son. And he took him out of her bosom and carried him off into a loft where he abode. And he laid him upon his own bed. And he cried unto the Lord and said, O Lord my God, hast thou also brought evil upon the widow with whom I sojourn by slaying her son? And he stretched himself upon the child three times and cried unto the Lord and said, O Lord my God, I pray thee, let this child's soul come into him again. Now, I'm not going to belabor the points on the types and shadows here, but notice he stretched himself upon the child three times. I'll just leave that for there for you to think about, right, and consider for a while. And the Lord heard the voice of Elijah, and the soul of the child came into him again, and he revived. And Elijah took the child and brought him down out of the chamber into the house and delivered him unto his mother. And Elijah said, see, thy son liveth. And the woman said to Elijah, now by this I know that thou art a man of God, and that the word of the Lord in thy mouth is truth. So that's the story of Elijah and the widow woman of Zarephath. Let's talk a little bit about Naaman. This is found in 2 Kings chapter 5. Naaman was a captain, and we're going to find out very quickly, of the Syrian host. Now, that doesn't sound like a good thing at all, does it? But he was a good man. He was an honorable man. He was an honest man. Matter of fact, we find out very quickly that Naaman, the Syrian captain, had a lot of very positive traits. He had one glaring, obvious problem. He was afflicted. He was afflicted with leprosy. You know what? I could probably use the same description of everybody in this room. This room is full of good people, honorable people, people that I consider to be honest, kind, compassionate, and loving. But every one of you have one glaring fault. You are afflicted with sin. And so am I. Leprosy is an Old Testament type of sin. Matter of fact, it's also a New Testament type of sin. It's a way for God to try to teach us lessons using natural elements that we can see and understand and touch and feel. Right? Now, I want to read Naaman's story because it's interesting and because I think it goes right along with the widow of Zarephath. And I think I can prove that. So just hang tight with me. I know I've said that twice. You're probably going, well, then prove it. I will. Just give me a little bit. Actually, I won't. I'll let somebody else prove that they're going to get it. How about that? That way you can worry about who it's going to be for a little bit. A few eyeballs just got big. Cool. All right, good. Just hang on to that thought. Now Naaman, captain of the host of the king of Syria, was a great man with his master and honorable, but because by him the Lord had given deliverance to Syria. And he was also a mighty man in valor, but he was a leper. Wow. It's almost like a side thought, isn't it? I know that in our modern times, the disease of leprosy isn't near as scary as it was in their days. But you can think of leprosy more like cancer. It's that word that when you hear it, all sense of feeling and understanding and all ability to continue to rationally think goes away. I remember sitting with people from time to time in hospitals, one in particular where a doctor came in the room while this lady's husband was in surgery and got her, and I went with her, and we're sitting with the doctor, and he basically explains to us that her husband is still open on the table, and he's there to ask her a question because they found something that they're not sure what it is, and he starts laying out the different options. And if it's this, he says, and we finish the surgery, then we've done an unnecessary surgery. If it's this and we don't finish the surgery, we'll be going back in later. And there is the possibility, he finally says, that it's cancer. And then he begins to explain what he means from this lady. And I could just see. I didn't have to hear. I could just look at her and realize that the minute he said the word cancer, all of her senses shut down. She wasn't hearing anything. She wasn't seeing anything. Her mind had taken over and was running away with whatever thoughts that she had. Leprosy was a similar concept in these days. It was awful. It was both painful. It was debilitating. But it was also disfiguring. I mean, you were ugly. You were unclean. You were also contagious. So you didn't have anybody. Nobody would touch you. Matter of fact, people wouldn't even get near you. That would be the difference between it and cancer, by the way. Yeah. In Israel, they were told that they would stay outside the camp. And if anybody came in their direction, they would shout, unclean, unclean. We're not in Israel now. So that law doesn't apply. But he was a leper. It says, and the Syrians had gone out by companies and had brought away captive out of the land of Israel a little maid, and she awaited on Naaman's wife. And we're going to find out that this little maid knew something about God and knew something about prophets and knew something about faith and knew something about how God dealt with his people. And just so happens, right? Just so happens that when Naaman takes his armies into Israel, just so happens that he ends up picking a little Hebrew woman who happens to be a woman of faith, who happens to know a prophet, who happens to understand that prophet has been endowed with great gifts and powers of healing. Just so happens, right, that Naaman picks that little Hebrew woman to be the handmaid of his own wife. No, it didn't just so happen. Can't believe y'all haven't corrected me by now. I mean, I've said it four times. Isn't the providence of God amazing? I think that's one thing we ignore way too much in the church today. Maybe it's out of fear of being accused of some other false doctrine. I don't know what the issue is. But we have laid the providence of God and the teaching of God's providence aside. I want you to understand something this morning, probably something I've heard lately that I like, that I hadn't heard in a long time. Predestination is for the hereafter. Predestination is the means by which God chose and predetermined the eternal destiny of his people. Providence is for the here and now. Amen. It is the means by which God intervenes in this world from time to time to create circumstance and, yea, may I say it, cause things as he chooses to come to pass. I notice I didn't say causes all things. I said he causes things. God is not a spectator in the stadium of life, sitting in the upper deck, watching this world unfold before him without intervening. God is actively involved in your life, and if you're one of his children, he knows when each and every hair of your head falls. He can number them and count them. He knows when a sparrow falls from the air. He knows everything about you and I. He knows everything that we're struggling with, everything that we're dealing with. He knows our problems and our difficulties and our trials, and he is there. He is not leaving you and will never leave you or ever forsake you. It is the providence of God that delivered this young lady into Naaman's household. Now notice what happens. And she said, the Hebrew girl, to her mistress, "Would God my Lord were with the prophet that is in Samaria, for he would recover him of his leprosy." Now Naaman had never considered the idea that he could be cured. That had never crossed his mind. Matter of fact, he didn't ask for it. He didn't go there. This little Hebrew girl comes into that household, realizes what an honorable house she's in spite of the fact that she is a Hebrew slave at this point. She looks at her mistress one day and says, "You know what? I really wish, we'll put it in our terms, I really wish your husband were with the prophet that I know in Samaria, because if he were with him, that prophet would remove his leprosy from him." Can you imagine what kind of news that was? You know what that's a type of? The gospel. Would to God that you knew the prophet that is in Israel. There is but one name by which men might be saved from their sin. And that's the name of Jesus Christ. We said, "Brother Martin, that sounds way too Arminian. Sounds like you're suggesting that we need to go and put ourselves before Jesus and we can be saved eternally by our own actions." And let me finish the story. May I finish the story and then have somebody prove that these two stories are related. And once I prove that these two stories are related, I think you'll begin to see that that's not the message at all. "And one went in and told his Lord, saying, thus and thus said the maid that is of the land of Israel." And I'm glad that the Bible uses phrases like that. You know, we go, "Well, they said so and so." Well, that's exactly what just happened right there. They said thus and thus. Maybe I'll start using thus and thus instead of so and so. But either way, it's neither here nor there, right? I love it. I'm glad. "And the king said, go, and I will send a letter unto the king of Israel. And he departed and took with him 10 talents of silver and 6,000 pieces of gold and 10 changes of raiment." Now, I'm going to tell you something. We start to see right here, very early on, part of the problem with Naaman. Naaman is a good man. He's an honorable man. He's a good captain. He's a man of great bravery and valor. But he's a man of some pride. And he's told that if he can go get himself before the prophet, this poor, undone prophet of Israel in Samaria, that if he can get himself before that prophet can heal him. And what does Naaman do? He doesn't send a letter to the prophet. He sends a letter to the king. Because a man of Naaman's stature would present himself before a king, not some lowly prophet. Right? It says, "And he brought the letter to the king of Israel." Now understand, Israel's already under serious control. That's why Naaman has a Hebrew slave. "And he went and brought the letter to the king of Israel, saying, now when this letter is come unto thee, behold, I have therewith sent Naaman my servant to thee, that thou mayest recover him of his leprosy." They're asking the king of Israel to recover Naaman of his leprosy. Isn't it interesting? "And it came to pass when the king of Israel had read the letter that he rent his clothes. Why? Because he wasn't able to do the request. And he was afraid. This was impossible. I'm being set up. That's what he says. Listen. Am I God to kill and to make alive, that this man does send to me to recover a man of his leprosy? Wherefore consider, I pray you, and see how he seeketh a quarrel against me. In other words, the king of Syria sent this letter that I be commanded to cleanse Naaman of his leprosy, because the king of Syria knew I would fail, and he could use that and as an occasion to bring accusation, quarrel, argument against me. I'm being set up. That's what the king of Israel says. Maybe if it had been like that little handmaid, and been a man of faith and understanding, maybe he would have done what she did and directed him to the right place. But it just so happens. Have you heard that before? And it was so, when Elisha, the man of God, had heard that the king of Israel had rent his clothes, and he went to the king, saying, wherefore hast thou rent thy clothes? Let him come now to me, and he shall know that there is a prophet in Israel. It just so happens that Elisha heard what had happened, and he showed up on his own, and he said, king, don't worry about this. Why have you torn your clothes? Send that man to me. And I'll tell you what, king, when he goes away from here, he'll know that there is a prophet in Israel. Guess who else would know? The king of Israel. But he's not the subject of the story. So Naaman came with his horses and with his chariot and stood at the door of the house of Elijah. This story is about to get real fun, because I love the way Elisha handles this. I love the way he handles it. It's just interesting. And Elisha sent a messenger unto him, saying, go and wash in Jordan 7 times, and thy flesh shall come again to thee, and thou shalt be clean. Anybody see a problem with this? Naaman did. Yeah. Naaman didn't like this at all, for a lot of reasons. I think that the bulk of Naaman's problem with this command from Elisha had little to do with the fact that he told him to go to the Jordan River. I think his anger was kindled at the very beginning when Elisha refused to come to the door. Listen to what he said. But Naaman was wroth and went away and said, behold, I thought he will surely come out to me. Come on, look at who I am. I'm the captain of the host of the Syrian army that has taken Israel. And this little poor prophet man in his little shack with his little servant, he wouldn't even come out and talk to me. No, he sends some little servant out, tells me to go down to some little muddy meager little piece of water over here that flows out of the Sea of Galilee into what? The Dead Sea? Come on! He tells me to wash myself in that mess. Who does he think he is? I mean, wouldn't he come out and talk to me face to face? Wouldn't that be the ultimate sign of respect? Naaman was wroth and went away and said, behold, I thought he would surely come out to me and stand and call on the name of the Lord his God and strike his hand over the place and recover the leper. Let me ask you something. How many of you have asked God for something in your life and have already decided how you want God to do it?
What'd you say?
How many of you go to God and say, Lord, I need something, and here's what I want? How many of us are praying for revival? How many of us wonder if we would even accept it when God actually sends it? Because it might not come in the fashion or form that we want. It might come in the fashion or form of shouting in our worship services. It might come in the fashion or form of persecution. An economic downfall of our nation. It might come in affliction and trial. It might only come if we're willing to give up some of our traditions. Shake loose some of the old rust and dust. It might come only when God does what the songwriter says when we sing it, if we don't really pay attention to it. And it says, Lord, take away every idol. That keeps me from you, essentially. It might only come when God does that. I look at Naaman's statement and I think, man, that is so close to me. I know what I want. I know how I want it. Naaman knew what he wanted. He wanted to be cleansed of leprosy. But not only did he want to be cleansed from leprosy, he wanted to be cleansed in such a way that it would be glorifying to himself, that it would be powerful, that he would... he wanted somebody to come. He wanted lightning bolts, what he wanted. He wanted some grand experiment. He wanted some grand design, right? He wanted to look like Thor's hammer hitting the ground. Laser bolt from nowhere. When the smoke cleared and the light dimmed, there would be Naaman, no leprosy. That's what he wanted. Not only did he not get that, he didn't get the prophet to come talk to him at all. The prophet sent some little messenger out and said, go down to Jordan there and dip yourself 7 times and then you'll be cleansed. You know what that sounds like? That sounds like your 5th period math teacher who had a long weekend and just wants you to be quiet for a couple of hours and wants you to do a bunch of work in the room, right? No offense to the math teachers in the room. I guess I could have picked on a different subject, I guess. Here's some handouts. Please just do these while I go sit over here. Yes. I wonder if Naaman thought that that's what the prophet was doing, is just trying to get Naaman out of the way. Go do something. How many times have we done that with our children when we've been trying to work on something and they're wanting to be involved, and we finally go get them their own block of wood, their own hammer, their own little nails. We set them over to the side and, here, pound on these, while we go back to what we were doing so that we can get it done. Naaman felt like he was being treated like a child, I think. Listen. Naaman has some suggestions on how this could be done, by the way. Don't we all? Are not Abinah and Pharpar, rivers of Damascus, better than all the waters of Israel? I mean, if you want to pick a river, I've got some better ones. May I not wash in them and be clean? So he turned and went away in a rage. Now, it just so happens... It just so happens he has a servant who is pretty wise. And listen to what his servant says. His servant came near and spake unto him and said, my father, Naaman, if you would, with all due respect, if the prophet had bid thee to do some great thing, wouldest thou not have done it? Oh, Naaman, the great leader of Syria and the Syrian army, if you wish to be cleansed of your leprosy, you must lead a battalion against Babylon. You must go through the mountains. Wouldn't Naaman have done that? Man, the glory in that. out on his chariot in front with sword in hand doing the bidding that he might be cleansed of his leprosy. But no, I want you to go down to a little muddy river and I want you to dip yourself 7 times. Somebody suggested, and the first time I read this story as I was studying on it, somebody suggested it was a story about simple obedience. No, it's not. Naaman resisted the entire time. And he went down to the Jordan only because he was shamed into it by his own servants. If the prophet had bid thee do some great thing, wouldst thou not have done it? How much rather then, when he saith to thee, wash and be clean. Naaman, he could have asked you something scary and hard and difficult, but he didn't. He just told you to go, why would you not do this? If it had been something difficult and hard and great, you would have done it. Now it's something simple. Why wouldn't you do that? He says, then he went down and dipped himself 7 times in Jordan, according to the saying of the man of God, and his flesh came again like unto the flesh of a little child, and he was clean. Now I want you to put yourself in Naaman's shoes for just a few minutes, because he is certainly not in a cooperative mode at that point. He goes down to that place in the Jordan River, and I don't know, maybe he laid aside all of his garments, maybe he pulled his armor off and laid his sword aside. I don't know exactly what it looked like, but I'm sure at this point, given the way it describes him, he had a good number of sores on his body that looked like boils that were into his flesh, and he was pretty disfigured, possibly. But can you imagine going down there with him and you dip yourself 1 time and there's no change? And a second time, and nothing happens. And a third, nothing. Four, five, six. Still nothing. And then finally, the 7th time, I don't know whether it was instant when he came up out of the water or whether it happened over a period of a few seconds as he watched the spots fade himself. But can you imagine what went through his head when he came forth from that place after dipping himself in that dirty, nasty, muddy Jordan River a 7th time? And the most deadly disease that we read about in Scripture that had afflicted him was now gone. Isn't that interesting? I think it's just powerful, by the way. So now let's talk about these two. So let me ask you a question. I told you that I was going to let somebody else prove that these two stories are related, so I'm going to in a few minutes. And I want to ask you some questions first. Do you see anything in common in these two stories? What do you see in common? Both involve prophets of God. They were almost spelled alike, right? That's not what I'm
talking about. They were both told to do something they wouldn't commonly do.
They were both told to do something that didn't make sense. That is really good, because oftentimes God tells us to do things that don't make sense, and we want to make sense of it, right? Both of these people were told to do things that didn't seem logical, that didn't seem right, and actually seemed like really strange requests. Yeah, Naaman has a point. There's a lot cleaner, a lot bigger, a lot more powerful rivers, a lot more fertile rivers in the world with more food, more fish. You know, even in his own country of Damascus, he could point out to two very quickly. It didn't make sense to go down to Jordan. Jordan's a place that flows into the Dead Sea. I mean, think about that for a minute. It flows into the Dead Sea. It's not exactly a life-giving river, is it? That's their thought process. Anything else? You haven't hit the key point. Pardon? Yeah, there were servants, Hebrew servants involved in both. Yeah.
Both told the people that they sent to what to do.
Yeah.
Impossible in a man's eyes.
True. They were both told to do things in order to get a result that was impossible in the eyes of men. True. Neither one of them really believed. That's getting closer to part of the issue here. They were both what? They were both resistant. You think of a reason why both of these people might have been resistant? They're told to do the impossible. There's something about their actual person that would make them pretty resistant. Okay. They're both Gentiles. Naaman was captain of the Syrian army. Right? The widow of Zarephath was from Zarephath. Well, that didn't take me long. Zarephath was a coastal city in Lebanon, what is modern-day Lebanon. It was just south of Sidon. We would call it Sidon. The Old Testament called it Zidon, right? Zarephath of Zidon. Okay? The New Testament would call Zarephath Sarepta, I believe is what it is. We're going to find out in just a minute. Because I'm going to let somebody else prove that these two stories are really related. Does anybody know who that person is that I'm going to let prove that?
Jesus.
That's exactly right. Because in Luke chapter 4, Jesus refers to these two stories together. And he makes a point. I've heard a lot of lessons taught from these two stories. And there are a lot of good lessons we can teach. Many of you have alluded to some of them. But there is one primary lesson that I don't think I've ever heard taught from an old Baptist pulpit. And it's shocking to me that I've never heard it taught for a couple of reasons. One, because it's one of the fundamental mainstays of our theology. And two, because Jesus taught this lesson from these two stories. And we just don't seem to get there. I don't know why. So let's go to where Jesus is talking about. I was going to read the entire part where Jesus was. We ran out of time for that. So here's what I'd like to do. I want to tell you that this occurs right on the heels of Jesus being baptized, of being taken up to the mountaintop and being tempted for 40 days and 40 nights. He comes down from the mountaintop and he goes in the Spirit of God, we're told. By the power of the Spirit of God, it says in verse 14, it says, and Jesus returned in the power of the Spirit into Galilee. So he goes to Galilee. And there he ministers for a little while. We don't know what all he did, but we know he did something because it says that his fame was spread through all the region round about. This is probably some of those miracles that John talks about at the end of his gospel when he says if everything that Jesus had done had been contained in a book, the world could not contain the books, right? There was a lot of things that Jesus did that we don't have record of, and this is probably one of those periods of time where Jesus was conducting miracles and doing things that spread his fame abroad. You know, we talk about the miracle at Cana, the wedding feast being the first, but there were certainly many, many more that we know nothing about. We have enough to understand who Jesus is, and we have all that we need. There's many more. Then after he leaves Galilee, it says in verse 16 that he came to Nazareth, which is where he was brought up. Now, how many of us, as we go through life, one of the first things we do, especially if we've moved away, we like to go back to where we were raised. And we have these grandiose ideas about what that was like, right? I remember, I still talk about it. Matter of fact, there's a part of me which is I never visited back there as an adult. Because it's not the same. You know, I remember thinking how large that valley was that we grew up in there in the mountains of eastern Kentucky. And how big the fields were, how tall the mountains were, how far apart the houses were. It just was all very big to me. And just a few years ago, I took my children, my wife, and we drove back up into there. One, to show them how far back in the boonies I lived. But two, just to see it all again. And when I got up there close to the house where I grew up, I realized it was all so much smaller than I remember it being. It was all so much smaller. Jesus goes back to Nazareth. And this story that we're about to read, or this exchange we're about to read, or these words of Jesus occur in Nazareth. Right? So he goes back to Nazareth there to minister, and he has some exchanges with some folks. And then we get down, let's see. We'll start in verse 23. It says, and he said unto them, you will surely say unto me this proverb, physician, heal thyself. Whatsoever we have heard done in Capernaum, do also here in thy country. So whatever we've heard that you've done elsewhere, we want you to do here. And he said, verily, Listen to this. He's talking to the people where he was raised, and he's going to quote the Old Testament. Verily, I say unto you, no prophet is accepted in his own country. You're not going to accept me no matter what I do. I know that. Because no prophet is accepted in his own country. And then he says this. I love this. But I tell you of a truth. Now remember, he's talking to Israelites here. I tell you, and don't forget, we've already established that the two people have one thing in common, and they are Gentiles. That's, you know, critical to the understanding of what he's about to say. He says, but I tell you of a truth, many widows were in Israel in the days of Elias when the heaven was shut up 3 years and 6 months. The Old Testament never told us the exact time period. It told us it was about 3 years. Some people have used this as a contradiction between the two. No, sir. This Old Testament's right. It was a little over 3 years. Jesus just happens to give us the details. You can trust that it was 3 years and 6 months. It was exactly that. 3 years and 6 months. Elias, when the heaven was shut up 3 years and 6 months, when great famine was throughout the land. Did you hear it? But I tell you the truth, many widows were in Israel. Hear it? There were a lot of widows in Israel who were suffering under the same burdens, the same problems, the same lack of rain, the same lack of food, when Elijah, the prophet, was alive. He says, but unto none of them was Elijah, that's the Greek rendition of Elijah, but unto none of them was Elias sent, save unto Sarepta. That's the Greek rendition of Zarephath. The city of Sidon. That's the Greek rendition of Zidon. This is the widow woman of Zarephath. Unto a woman that was a widow. Think about it a minute. There were hundreds, maybe thousands. I do not know the numbers, but I can imagine, given the population of Israel and Jerusalem in that area at that time, that there were literally hundreds, probably thousands of widows who were suffering and enduring the same famine, the same shortage of meal, the same shortage of oil, the same problems. But God did not send Elijah to any of those women. He sent him to a little Gentile woman on the coast of Lebanon. And there he meted out his blessings to her. Think about that. Hang on to that for a second. Because he says next in verse 27, and many lepers. See, leprosy was not an uncommon disease. It was a death sentence for the most part. It was certainly a sentence to loneliness, a life of isolation and tragedy. But it obviously was not uncommon. It was not rare. Because he says, Jesus tells us, there were many lepers in Israel. There it is again. There were many lepers in Israel in the times of Elias. The Greek form of Elisha, the prophet, and none of them was cleansed, saving Naaman the Syrian. There it is. Same issue. And Jesus points to the same commonality between the two stories. Notice that what Jesus is pointing to is this, that in both cases, there were plenty of objects, potential objects of God's grace within Israel that God could have chosen to send a prophet and bless. But God made a sovereign and divine choice to send his prophets, both of them, individually, to a Gentile person and to send his blessings sovereignly and by his choice upon them. And may I ask you, what would be the normal response of every Israelite that would hear such? And I'll save you the trouble, because Sister Kathy's back there shaking her head and mouthing, "That's not fair." And she's right. How many times have you heard, "That's not fair"? But Jesus is teaching us right now, right here, in this place, that his choice of dispensation of grace, and I'm not talking about a time period when I say dispensation, I'm talking about the giving out of it. His choice in meeting out grace, giving mercy, is sovereign and upon his own choice. What is Jesus teaching with these two stories? May I boil it down and may we conclude. He's teaching this. It is not of him that willeth. Amen. See, it's not of the person that makes a decision. You can teach me all about decisional regeneration you want. You can talk to me about decisional salvation. Just make a decision for Christ and you'll be okay. That's not what Jesus said. Jesus said, it's not of him that willeth. It's not of him that runneth. In other words, it's not of him that works. You can decide, well, it's not a decision that counts. It's how much labor I put into it. It's how much effort I engage into this. It's how hard I work in that direction. How hard I believe. And what does Jesus say? No. It's not of him that willeth. It's not of him that runneth. But it is of God that showeth mercy.
Amen.
See, these were acts of actual mercy because these were people that under the current definition of the terms did not deserve anything from God. They were both Gentile people. They were aliens from the commonwealth of Israel. They were separated. And God chose them. And God sent his blessings to them sovereignly. These two stories are not types of obedience and timely salvation. You could probably teach some good lessons about that from it. But the ultimate lesson in these two stories is the sovereignty of God in the dispensation of grace and mercy. My God is a sovereign God. And he will bestow his grace upon whomever he will. And I tell you, people say that's not fair. They also tell me from time to time that God won't save anybody against their will. And I always tell them at that point, I've never met anybody who was saved that wanted to get rid of it. If God didn't save people against their will, like he did Naaman, nobody's going to heaven. Because none of us were willing. There was none that sought after God. There was none righteous. No, not one. It's only when God invaded our hearts and changed our innermost being, turned our lives upside down, changed our motivations, changed our desires, changed our wants, changed our wishes. It's only after God did that that we became willing participants in the grace of God. Up until then, if somebody had offered it to us, we'd have said thanks, but no thanks. I'm fine. I've got it together. And if we didn't say that, if we said, you know what, that sounds pretty good to me, you know what that would have meant? That would have meant God had already changed your heart. And they were just too late to get there before him. May God bless us to see the sovereignty of God in the dispensation of his grace and mercy. We're going to stand.